Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Mike Finnegan has toured and has been a session musician for Jimi Hendrix, Joe Cocker, Etta James, Sam Moore, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Dave Mason, Buddy Guy, Manhattan Transfer, Taj Mahal, Michael McDonald, Maria Muldaur, Peter Frampton, Cher, Ringo Starr, Leonard Cohen, Tower of Power, Rod Stewart, David Coverdale, Tracy Chapman, Los Lonely Boys, and Bonnie Raitt, and the list goes on and on. This is one of those guys you just have to name drop. Mike got his start playing professionally in 1964 in Kansas. He then moved to Wichita and traveled the country with the Surfs. It was during a trip to New York City that Mike recorded with Jimi Hendrix, a session that resulted in the legendary release Electric Ladyland. In 1972, Michael formed Finnegan and Wood. In 1975, Mike put down roots in L.A., where he pursued more group and solo recordings, while at the same time touring with recording with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Dave Mason, Etta James, Dr. John, Carlos Santana, Joe Cocker, and Bonnie Raitt. He is twice a winner of Blues Music Award, formerly the W.C. Handy Award, for his work with Taj Mahal. Finnegan had always been active politically and was for several years a regular contributor to the web blog Crooks and Liars. Please welcome legendary keyboardist, singer, session, and touring player Mike Finnegan to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Ray. Thanks for that intro.
It's hard to do one interview with you. You got so much that you've done in your lifetime.
Well, you know, I've been here a while.
Yeah. I can see that. One thing I got to mention, man, you have an incredible voice. You are the real deal.
Well, that's very nice of you. Thank you.
Someone commented on YouTube. They said, when a talent like Mike Finnegan isn't famous, there's something wrong in this country. And I agree.
Well, you know, like, we can't all be famous. I mean, there are all kinds of people. You can, you know, in my travels, I've heard a lot of great musicians or great singers. And, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, you got to be a little lucky. It's better to be lucky than good. It's really better to be lucky and good.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. I just want to also tell you, congratulations. I believe it's 50 years that you've been married to Candy now.
That's right. 50 years. Yeah, that's a, you know, I'll tell her you congratulated her. She's the one that made that possible.
You know, every great man says that. I mean, they always say, you know, behind a great man is a great woman, and that's 100%.
In this case, it's in front of a man is a great woman.
I just celebrated 37 years, so
that's wonderful. Good for you.
Yeah, we're a rare breed, I think, nowadays. But you know, it's the old timers that still make it work.
Yeah, I guess so. I think people maybe today are a little bit less likely to put up with, you know, the normal flaws in every human being. And, you know, I think that long-term relationships require a good deal of give and take and understanding and the recognition that, you know, everybody's going to fall short from time to time. And if you're looking for perfection, then you should try something other than a human.
Exactly. Yeah.
Maybe just stick with a pet dog or something, you know?
Or a robot. I mean, that's getting popular now.
Yeah, right.
But I'm a believer that, you know, usually the woman is always right, and don't argue with her. You're only asking for trouble.
Well, you know, my wife's right more often than not.
Right.
You know, I guess that's because my experience is that my wife remembers everything.
Yeah.
And I only remember some things. But she remembers everything, and so, like, she's a very good source for advice on any subject because of her long memory of the entire history of our whole relationship.
Right, right. She fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
I want to start out talking about your past, and then we'll get into what you got going on lately.
All right.
I always liked Les Dudek. When I first heard him, you know, I was really impressed by Les, and you did a few things with Les in the past.
Yeah.
And you also, you had the DFK band with him,
that's
right?
That's right. Yeah, Les and I met in the 70s, and as it happened, we were all being managed by the same guy, and Jim Krieger and I had been playing with Dave Mason, and we had the same manager, and then we met Les, who had the same manager, and we were all on Columbia, and I wound up playing on a couple of Les's albums, and then that led to more, you know, I mean, we were kind of, you know, there was a lot of kind of crossbreeding going on as far as, like, he was appearing, playing on my stuff, and I was playing with him. So we put a band together that actually was the idea came from the label from Columbia, the higher ups at that point. And as it happened, by the time we finished the album, several of the biggest or most influential people at that label had moved on to other labels, and nobody wanted to take ownership of this orphan, you know. And so we had an album where all the guys at the top were going, this isn't my thing.
Yeah, that's a shame, because you guys were so talented, too.
Oh, it was a really good band, and I was, you had good taste. That was a really great musician.
Yeah, Les Dudek's, what, you know, one of my favorite songs he did was Old Judge Jones. And you guys did Ghost Town Parade together, which had a great lineup. I mean, Jeff Porcaro, Jim Keltner, Jack Bruce, Carmine Appice.
Yeah, Carmine Appice.
Appice, yeah.
Let me help you with your Italian.
Appice. Appice. Yeah, I've had Carmine on the show a few times.
Have you really?
Yeah, he corrects me.
That's good. Well, I saw the list of all the people you've interviewed, and it's impressive that you don't stick with only the household names, but you move down the list to lots of different musicians and people and other businesses that, you know, are very, contribute a lot that maybe a lot of people don't know about.
Well, somebody's got to do it, right?
Well, they don't have to. That's what's good about doing it.
Well, I love music. You know, it's in my blood. You know, music can save the world, in my opinion. So I love doing what I do.
Well, you know, that's important.
Yeah. I was really surprised, too. Big Brother and Holding Company. Now, were you a member of the band, or you just toured with them?
Well, actually, I did. I think I did. I'm trying to remember. That was like back in like 1970,
right?
When I first moved to San Francisco, I did an album or possibly a couple albums with them.
You did.
I didn't really tour with them. I did a couple of shows with them. I think I did a couple big festivals with them at the time we were making those albums. And, you know, I just moved to San Francisco and to join this band called the Jerry Hahn Brotherhood.
Right.
And that was a very kind of groundbreaking fusion type band. Like, that was before the word fusion was even around, or had been coined. And, you know, I was in town and there was still a lot of recording going on in San Francisco. That's how I met them and wound up, you know, playing. I played on an album with this band called Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show.
Oh, yeah.
That period, too.
Did you really?
That was they had a bunch of hits and were recording in San Francisco. And so I was lucky enough to get plugged into the session scene in San Francisco not too long after I got there.
Yeah, I had Dennis on the show, Dennis LeCourier.
Uh-huh.
He's a great guy, man. I love him.
Yeah, I really like those guys. I've had a great time playing with them.
Well, Big Brother, you were on Be a Brother, which was 1970. You were on How Hard It Is, which was released in 71. You were on both of those albums. You know, I always thought Big Brother and the Holding Company was a very underrated band. I thought they were a great band. I mean, you know, not even without Janis Joplin.
Well, you know, they were pretty good guys, and I mean, they kind of were part of the whole, you know, the very seminal movement in San Francisco that was kind of with the rock music explosion that occurred there in the late 60s.
Right.
And one of the first bands, along with the Grateful Dead, that achieved some kind of local popularity that turned into national popularity.
Yeah. And of course, then you got into meeting Jimi Hendrix, which is, you know, that's to talk about the internet when you mention your name. And
that actually occurred in '68.
Yeah,
and I think that movie that record came out in '68, and that's when I was still living in Kansas. I was still living in Wichita, and I just happened to be in New York making an album with my band, The Surfs, and that's how I met him. We were working in the same studio at the record plant in New York, and just happened to run into each other, and he invited me to, and a couple of the other guys in my band join him on a song, and we were in there in the mornings and afternoons, and he was coming in about 5 in the afternoon to work in the evenings. That's how that happened.
Yeah, you did Oregon on Rainy Day, Dream Away, and Still Raining, Still Dreaming.
That was actually all one long piece that we did that he cut up into two pieces and wrote some lyrics to. It was just an instrumental kind of jam thing that we did on the spot, you know.
And you worked with one of my favorite drummers, Buddy Miles.
Yeah, Buddy was from Omaha, and we actually had known Buddy before that period, and he had been in a band in Omaha called the Stragglers, a good rhythm and blues band, and was kind of a young phenom guy. He was a couple years younger than we were, and had, you know, gone on to join the Electric Flag, and he just happened to be in New York at that time and was hanging around and, you know, jumped in.
Yeah, I talked to Billy Cobham. He was friends with Buddy Miles. He told me that Buddy was a pretty damn good guitar player as well.
Well, he could play a little bit. I wouldn't know if he was damn good, but he could. I saw him with one in his hand one time.
Right.
I'm just kidding. I mean, he played a little bit, you know, but he was a drummer.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you play, when I think about all the great guitar players I've known, I don't think of Buddy Miles, but I do think of him when it comes to drumming.
Yeah.
And singing. He was a great singer, too.
Yeah. Great musician. And, of course, you were shamming the bass line on that tune.
Well, you know, that was Buddy's term. I don't know what that means. I was, you know, playing the whole organ in those days. I was playing foot pedals and left-hand bass. And that was something that Jimmy actually wanted on that track. he was like, when he was doing his, when I met him, he was doing rhythm tracks for that album.
Right.
And he was doing it only with himself and Mitch Mitchell playing drums. There was no, the bass player wasn't in town for some reason.
Huh.
And, they, you know, which is, it was a revelation to me because I'd never seen anybody work that way, but he had a vision of what he was looking for on that album and, was working at it very painstakingly and carefully, and you know, that particular what wound up to be two tracks that I played on were kind of anomalies. And there was another one or two tunes on that album that had some other guy, Steve Winwood, played organ on a track, and I'm trying to think of the guy's name from. Oh man, Jefferson Airplane, the bass player, Jack Cassidy, he played on it too.
Right, right. Yeah, and now I'm having a hard time thinking. Oh well, I'll come back to it.
Okay.
That's what happens when you get older.
I get it, man.
That's what happens when you get older. Oh, Dave Mason, of course, played.
Dave
played
Mason, right?
Yeah.
He played guitar on All Along the Watchtower.
Yeah. I talked to Dave, too. He, another great guy. You know, we talked about the Traffic days, and he told me how one day Steve Winwood stopped talking to him, and that was the end of that. He didn't know why. He just stopped talking to him.
That's cold.
Yeah,
well, I've worked with Dave for several years.
He's a good guy. He does a lot for the vets, and you know, really.
Yeah,
good guy.
He is a good guy.
Yeah,
I did about three or four albums with Dave.
Yeah, I saw that. I did see that, and he's still going strong.
Actually, I spoke to a guy that's like helping him. A professional writer that's helping him write an autobiography right now.
Awesome. You should be doing that.
That started it.
Yeah. Have you thought about doing that yourself?
No, not really. I mean, to be honest, you know, when you're a musician and you've had so many, we've had like 56 years in this business and a lot of experience and met so many wonderful people and a few maybe not so wonderful people and, I think that I may have read one or two musical biographies or autobiographies that I thought were interesting. It's like, you know, when you're in it, it's not like, it's not something you think is particularly fascinating, if you understand what I mean.
Sure, I understand, yeah. But it is afterwards, after you start reading it.
Yeah, I mean, 90% of the best stuff I could tell, I probably wouldn't want to tell.
Well, that's the good stuff, though.
That's what I mean. You know, Mark Twain wrote a biography that the caveat for him with the publishers was, this can't be published until 100 years after I'm dead. Because, like, he just ripped all kinds of people and told a whole lot of stuff that maybe wouldn't have been okay back when he was alive.
I know.
So I don't think that anybody would be interested in buying anything that I might write 100 years from now, and I don't know if about a half a dozen would be interested right now.
Yeah. Well, if you want to, you know, spill your guts, it'll probably be a New York bestseller.
Right.
I'll be your ghostwriter.
Yeah, we could, you know, the tell-all.
Yeah, there you go.
How to make everybody hate you that you know in about a week.
Yeah.
There,
yeah. Was, did you actually tour with Hendrix?
No, I never toured with him. I just recorded with him.
Because on Wikipedia, there's a picture there. I don't know if you saw it or not.
Oh, that isn't even my picture.
Did you see? Why did they even put that in there? Who put that in?
I don't know. Some fool got on there and put that in. You know, if I gave a damn about Wikipedia, I probably ought to go on there and straighten that whole page out. It's got a lot of bad info in it. But, you know, it's not something that really concerns me.
Yeah, it says
you know,
that you were...
I probably ought to care more about it. In fact, talking to you, it makes me kind of ashamed that I haven't taken any action to straighten that out.
Well, I can go in there. Anybody can go in there and edit.
That's what I mean. mean.
Yeah.
You know, there's another site called Real Wiki.
Right.
I don't know if I'm even in there, but that's funny. Anybody can go in there and put anything they want, so it's not exactly the most reliable source.
Now, they put a lot of stuff that I've written, but it's all good stuff. You know, like I figured out, God, what is wrong with me today?
That's okay.
Anything, I Norman Greenbaum, you know, I've got out of him what the real meaning behind his, gosh, what is wrong? The meaning behind his, one hit wonder. That's in Wikipedia.
Spirit in the Sky.
Thank you. What sparked him to write that song, you know? That's in there, and I talked to Keith Emerson about this flying piano, and that's in there. So it's all good stuff. I don't put it in there. Other people, put it in there. But I'm going to say...
Well, those are kind people. Then there's the people that put a picture of somebody else on my page.
I don't get that, yeah, because I was going to say, wow, you toured with Hendrix, and you were there at one of his last performances in Seattle? You know, I was like, wow.
Yeah, it sounds good, but it isn't true.
What do you think Hendrix would have been doing if he was alive today? What kind of music do you think? You think he would have been...
Oh, my Lord. It's hard to imagine. He was such a... it's hard to even kind of come up with that. He was such a revolutionary kind of musician in his time. And he certainly changed the way people made records. He changed the way people understood the guitar and what could be done with it. He was, essentially, if you listen to his music carefully and just, especially at a remove like right now when you listen, 4 years later to the things he recorded, he was essentially a blues player.
Right, right.
And the difference, the difference was sonically, it had to do with, not to say that he was a master technician and had a tremendous facility on the instrument and just had a deep understanding of the possibilities of the kind of sounds that you get from the guitar. And he was a very kind of revolutionary producer and explored the limits of recording.
Right, right. Yeah, he was definitely an intelligent...
At that time. He really made a difference in how people made records in that period.
Right.
His influence was really... It was huge, What he would be doing probably if he were alive was he'd still be playing, and he'd be playing great. And how that would manifest itself is, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I could see him doing some fusion, and changing up a little bit, from the rock and doing some other stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's possible.
Yeah.
He was, I did an album, I don't know, probably 20 years ago, maybe longer, but that Eddie Kramer, who was the engineer and worked with Jimmy on his album.
Yep.
And it was a tribute record, and he brought in a whole bunch of different guitar players and a lot of musicians and, people like Robin Ford and some guys that were actually more jazz-oriented musicians,
mm-hmm.
And to play on that. And I think the reason he did that was because a lot of those younger guys that wound up being jazz players, although Robin Ford's an excellent blues player too. Jazz and blues are connected, but I think Eddie just understood that those guys might have a better understanding of how to interpret Jimi Hendrix's music without just being imitative,
Right, right. I could see him playing with John McLaughlin and Cobham and, with you. You'd be a great singer with Hendrix, you know?
That would have been all right with me.
One album I always remember growing up, it was the Early Bird Cafe and The Surfs.
That's interesting that you remember that.
That's a good album. I mean, I'm a Man. You did that version of Spencer Davis Group, and I think that came out before Chicago.
Yeah, we did that, and we also incorporated the Muddy Waters, Manish Boy, in that, which, that title is like, it was both of those things. So, the Surfs, that was a band that I had in Kansas, and that was a really good rhythm and blues band. We did all kinds of music, and great musicians, and an excellent songwriter named Lane Teigen.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up having a club in Wichita for about a year called the Early Bird Cafe.
Right. You know, a lot of groups and solo artists have used that on their albums, the Early Bird Cafe. It's been used a lot now since then.
Well, I've heard that. Yeah. I know John Mellencamp recorded.
John Mellencamp, yeah. Yep, see what you started?
Yeah. Well, it's the music there for everybody.
Exactly, exactly. That was a really good band. And you were lead vocalist on The Surfs, right? In The Surfs?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We made that album when I met Jimi Hendrix. The difference was we made our album in about 8 days, and he made his in about 8 months.
8 months, wow. Yeah.
So,
but, some of the greatest musicians record in one take, It's amazing.
Well, that's the take you want.
That's the take you want.
I mean, if it happens.
Yep.
There's always, when you're recording, if you're with the right people, then, and the material is understood and people are really, there's either the really lucky spontaneity of like first take or, but with good people, usually if after three or four takes, it's in there someplace.
Yeah, that's true.
Past that, it's people start thinking too much.
Exactly.
whatever was supposed to happen might get buried in intellectualizing.
It's like, when you take a test and usually your first answer is the right answer.
Well, yeah, your initial, like I said, your initial impulses are usually good, and it usually just comes down to execution. And
yep.
If your initial impulse is good, then even if the execution isn't perfect, the sum total is something special.
Exactly.
Something unique and good.
Yeah. You've got you're on YouTube a lot. I saw you there with Bonnie Raitt. I Got News for You, which is phenomenal. I mean, I love
thanks.
It. Love it. Also, you're there with, you're doing Love the One You're With Stephen Stills.
I think
back in 90. You got a lot of good footage on YouTube.
Well, when you play a lot of music and, live situations, that's, something that we have now
is
YouTube that, a lot of performances are saved there for better or worse.
Right? Yeah, I know.
And, sometimes it's like somebody's iPhone. I would like when I was playing with Bonnie, she used to especially when we played in theaters and stuff, she'd ask people not to do that, and basically just because, not because she didn't want it out there so much, it's like, hey, we're so old, we remember when we went to concerts and listened to the music with our own ears and watched it with our own eyes.
Exactly.
You could just be in the moment if you want. You don't have to save it.
Yeah. I believe in that. I don't like it when people pull out their their phones and start recording and things like that. It's annoying. It really is.
Well, it can be, yeah. It's like when I'm at a hockey game or a baseball game and I see people looking at the screen and I'm going, look, there's baseball out there. You know.
That's true. I went on Bonnie Raitt's website and you're there. I mean, you know, she does mention you. Do you still work with Bonnie? Do you still do a lot of things with Bonnie?
No, I mean, I haven't been working with Bonnie for a while.
Right.
I actually had a hip replacement and a back surgery.
Oh, wow.
Kind of knocked me off the road for a while. And, you know, I'm not touring right now very much. I'm just kind of, I'm doing a lot of session work here in L.A.
Right.
Make some occasional, you know, short trips with the Phantom Blues Band, but I don't expect to be doing any long tours anytime soon.
Yeah. I guess the good thing is you can still do session work from home, right? You can just kind of send
it
in?
You can do that. I get a lot of files sent to me from people all over the world.
Wow.
Overdub organ or piano on or vocals. And
that's great.
And that's, yeah, I don't really do it at home, but I have a studio I work at where I have a Hammond organ and some other keyboards and, you know, and good microphones and, you know, a way to you know, do some overdubbing for people that sounds like it's good, you know.
Right. You work with, I think he produced one of your albums, Jerry Wexler?
Oh, yeah, Jerry Wexler. What a giant.
Wow.
He was like in the beginning of Atlantic Records.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which was a tremendous record label that actually was responsible for bringing a lot of black artists to the white public.
Right.
You know, that up until Atlantic came along, Atlantic was certainly one of the first and most influential labels that presented black artists nationally to the white public. You know, there were, up until the early 50s, really, there, you know, a lot of black artists were kind of marginalized, they were marginalized.
Right.
More,
right.
You know, relegated to small regional labels where, you know, their music was mostly only heard, in the region where the label existed. And also for people that were interested enough in that kind of music to find it, you know. Jerry coined the term rhythm and blues.
That's huge. That's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was working with him, he was like a walking encyclopedia of popular American music.
Yeah.
I had the best time with him.
Yeah.
And just hanging out and talking to him and just, you know, getting, I mean, I used to just coax him and talk to him and ask him questions about different artists and recording, you know, like people like Ray Charles and Solomon Burke and different, you know, some of the early artists that put Atlantic on the map, you know, and
yeah.
It was just a thrill to be to work with him. And the way it happened was so strange because he just called me out of the blue and I had never met Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, this is Jerry Wexler. You know, I like the way you sing, man. I think we should make a record.
Wow.
And I just thought it was a joke. You know, I thought, who is this? You know, one of my buddies is putting me on.
That's funny. I just talked to Dennis Mackay, who's a engineer. Producer, he said the same thing when George Martin called him. He thought it was a joke. It's funny.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you never think, like, how's this guy found, you know, what's he doing calling me?
Yeah. Unfortunately, Jerry passed away here. I'm in Sarasota, Florida, and he's buried here as well, but he spent his last days here.
I know he did.
Yeah.
I used to talk to him fairly often.
Yeah.
Just call him and see how he was doing. He
right.
was funny, too, because I remember, you know, one of the last times I talked to him, I, I said, how you doing, Jerry? And he goes, how you think I'm doing? I'm 95 years old. You know, I'm not doing worth a damn, but yeah. Thanks for asking.
That's funny. My dad is 95 years old. He just turned 95.
Man, that's amazing.
Yeah, he was in World War II, Marine Corps, vet, Saipan, Okinawa. Yeah, we take care of him. He's doing great. It's amazing.
Well, that's good. Yeah. You're lucky to have him so long.
Exactly. Another guy I'm very impressed by, I think you had something to do with helping him, was D.A. Foster.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's an old friend of mine, and he's got a fat. His history is really interesting because he had one of the biggest and best clubs on in the East called the Shabu.
Mm-hmm.
The Shabu Inn, and it was in kind of between stores where UConn is and Willimantic, Connecticut, and it was a popular stop for a lot of artists that were working on, you know, when touring on the East Coast that needed to fill a date. But he had a big room. It was, would hold 1,000 people, and he had everybody in his club. I mean, when he first opened that joint, he was too young to be in it. I mean, he was only about 17 or something, him and a couple people.
Uh-huh.
Put this place together, and he had everybody from Muddy Waters to Miles Davis.
Wow.
In the room. And just, you know, all kinds of, all the greats, and just, you know, a tremendous list of artists that appeared at his club, and then he wound up working with Matt Murphy, who had played with Howlin' Wolf and did a lot of the early Chess records in Chicago, and that's how he got in the business as a singer, working with Matt Guitar Murphy. And people that may not know who that is off the top of their heads, he was in that Dan Aykroyd
Blues Brothers?
No, the Blues Brothers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Matt was prominently featured in that film.
What a voice, D.A. I guess they call him Lefty? Is that his nickname?
Lefty's his nickname, yeah.
He's kind of like a Lou Rawls type voice, you know. He's got that.
Yeah, he's a baritone, which is a kind of unusual one in rhythm and blues and all kinds of popular music. There's not most male singers are tenors,
right?
But David has like that, you know, that deep quality, and he's really soulful and good. And mm-hmm. I had a chance to co-produce with mm-hmm. Tony Bronigal, who's a great drummer and friend of mine in the Phantom Blues Band, and we produced an album on D.A. Foster. It's a great record, I think.
Yeah. Both of you have legendary voices. I've never heard a voice like yours for such a long time. You know, it's very soulful, you know. I'm very impressed.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Who were some of the artists that you admired growing up and that influenced you in becoming a musician?
Well, I was lucky enough to grow up in a home that both my parents sang, and mm-hmm. They were both really good singers, and, you know, that just they were part of a music club where I grew up in Troy, Ohio. And,
right.
And they had all kinds of records, and there was a lot of music in the house, so I was kind of inoculated, you know, from an early age with everything from Louis Armstrong to Bing Crosby to Art Tatum and Mahalia Jackson and all kinds of really good music. And but when I started buying my own records when I was about 11 years old or so, I was just attracted to mostly rhythm and blues music,
yeah.
And like Fats Domino and Little Richard and Bobby Bland and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the people that influenced me the most, I think.
I think a lot of people, like, they started out with the Dave Brubeck records, too. He was a big influence on a lot of people.
Well, Dave Brubeck kind of brought jazz to the...
Yeah.
To a wider audience, you know, his the big album for him was an album called Time Out.
Yep.
Where he was experimenting with different time signatures. And, of course, Take Five was a big hit off that record, which was kind of strange because his quartet had been playing for a while. And, you know, like it wasn't until they made that album that they achieved popularity with a wider audience. Of course, Paul Desmond was the alto player in his group, and he had a very unique alto sound, and that went a long way, I think, in helping make them popular with a wider audience. But that's one of those anomalies where, you know, a jazz group that's been working in relative anonymity for a good period of time all of a sudden broke into the mainstream for a minute there.
Yeah, I love jazz. I really do. I wish it was, you know, more apparent than it is nowadays. But
You know, I think there's a wide audience for all kinds of music now.
Yeah.
The problem is there's nowhere to see it except for concert halls.
Exactly.
And, you know, there used to be, when I was starting out, there were like lots of nightclubs that had, you know, live music. I guess it was because, I mean, at that time, television was sort of important, but not as important as it is now. There was no internet, so it was just kind of between, you know, films and a little bit of TV, but people went out more.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep.
People went out to hear live music and to dance mostly. That's what it was for. And so there was a lot of opportunities for people to experience live music and a lot of opportunities for musicians to work.
Yeah. You know, they could say what they want about disco, but disco is probably about the last era with live music. You know, all the clubs had live bands at that time. And
and even then there were fewer. I mean, you know, in Kansas City there were at least 25 places that had live music, and then there were another 20 with at least a trio or a piano player.
Exactly.
And, you know, same thing with Wichita and Tulsa and all the places that I played when I was starting out before we started moving, you know, and we worked all across the country in nightclubs all through the 60s.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can rehearse all you want, but, you know, it's playing gigs that makes it for you. It really gets you familiar with what you're doing and comfortable and, you know, like, 4 or 5 hours a night, 6 or 7 nights a week will get you half good, and, you know, not too long.
I grew up in D.C., and we had Georgetown, and we had the Cellar Door, which was...
I remember that place.
Yeah, very, very popular for, you know, musicians to come in. Some of the legendary artists played the Cellar Door.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people played that room. I played there.
Yep.
You know, that was a place, you know, that was kind of like the Shabu that I was talking about that my friend D.A. Foster had, except the Shabu was much bigger.
Yep.
And it was a stop for everybody, just like the Cellar Door. A lot of people played there.
Yeah, Bonnie Raitt was a regular, you know, she was always there. Yeah. Let's go to now to the present. The Phantom Blues Band. I love that band.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I love it too.
I guess the latest album, was that Inside Out? Was that the last recording?
Well, we got another one coming out in March.
Awesome.
Called Still Cooking.
Awesome.
And
we
finished that up, and it's going to be out in March, and we're doing, like I said, we're doing some live shows. I'm going to Panama in about a month, I guess. We're going to go down to Panama and play a festival down there. And we've got quite a few shows that we're doing throughout the summer at different festivals. And plus the fact that I should mention that I'm working on a solo album right now.
Oh, great.
and it's going to be on Joe Bonamassa's label.
Really?
Which, yeah.
Huh. Does he play on the album?
He's going to.
That's a pretty good collaboration there.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. You know, I'm grateful to Joe for giving me the opportunity to do this album, and a good friend of mine named J.J. Blair, who's an engineer and producer and musician, is the producer, and he's the guy he's been nagging me to do a solo album for about 15 years, and I finally caved in, and we did some tracks. He took it to Joe, and Joe said, "Yeah, man, I'm gonna put this out." So,
wow,
it's I'm really grateful.
I'm gonna get after this interview. I'm gonna give you my email address so you can give me all the links when all the albums are out, so I can promote it.
Well, thank you. I will send it to you, of course.
Maybe
I'll send you a couple of rough mixes too, just to advise you.
That'd be great. That'd be awesome. Another duo. I'd love to see you and Beth Hart do something together. You know Beth?
She's great.
Isn't she good? Yeah.
She's really good.
I've had her on the show. She's such a nice person, and she's out there promoting the blues. So, we stand with her as well. I wanted to talk. The Phantom Blues Band actually started out with you. Were you backing up Taj Mahal? Were you kind of his band?
Yeah, those guys, I didn't get with the Phantoms until 2000.
Okay.
And before that, they had spent like 2 or 3 years playing with Taj. And
right.
They played on a Grammy-winning album of Taj's, Senior Blues. And then I replaced John Cleary in that band, and I've been playing with him ever since and done a lot with Taj, a couple albums, mm-hmm. and a lot of live work with Taj Mahal.
Another legend.
And we're still playing with him from time to time.
Yeah. So it's you on keys and vocals. There's Larry, right? Fulcher?
Larry Fulcher is the bass player.
Right. Johnny Lee Shell?
Johnny Lee Shell and on guitar, and Tony Bronigal's the drummer, and we had a couple horn players. Les Lovett is the trumpet player in the band now, and the tenor man is Joe Sublett.
Awesome.
Well, and we were talking the other day. Somebody, I think Johnny was doing an interview with somebody, and he said collectively we have about 300 years of experience.
Yeah. It's about right.
And I mean, all of those guys have got, credits like mad, with everybody from the Rolling Stones to Jimmy Smith to, John Fogerty and Bonnie and all kinds of people that we've all played with. I mean, it just goes on and on between that we all haven't played with, but between, all the guys in the band have all appeared on, hundreds of records.
Nowadays it's hard to find this caliber of a musician anymore, on a record. It really is.
Well, it is, but, they'll... in another 50 years, you'll be talking to some guy like me, like it's done a million things or not.
Or not. It'll all be electronic, electronic made music somehow, it won't be, which is a shame because they're making instruments today where they can, it can just do anything. You can play a whole band out of a, out of a keyboard,
Yeah, well, that's synthesizers have been able to do that for a while, but, I've never understood music where people, where somebody plays all the instruments and does all the singing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, what happened to, collaboration? And I think they call that playing with yourself.
That's funny. That'll be my headline of this story.
there's nothing like the communication. You know, and that's another thing that occurs in the live situation.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much at, you know, the huge festival, but in, you know, in a room with a few hundred people or something, and, you know, five or six musicians that are communicating in that moment and with those people, and those people are communicating back to the band, and something happens. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like I met this kid at my gym the other day that was with his dad, and his dad introduced me to his son, who's about, I don't know, 18, 19 years old, and he's, you know, got the earbuds working, and he's telling this kid, you know, this Mike Finnegan, he's done this, that, and this kid is like, oh, I've heard of that, yeah, you know, and I love music, and so forth, and I said, when's the last time you were in a club at midnight with 100 people and everybody sweating and you know, rocking? And he said, well, I don't think I ever have. And I said, well, you got to do that. And I pointed to his iPod and said, you know, it's not in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, yeah.
I mean, there's a facsimile of it in there, but
right. That's
not it.
Exactly. The old days where you're in a jazz club and, you know, drinking away and, oh, man, to me, that's life.
Yeah, well, a lot of people haven't experienced it, you know.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, that's what's sad about, you know, I mean, technology has done a lot for us, certainly, and there's a...
Yep.
There's, you know, it makes a lot of music more widely available, and to more people, and music from all kinds of different cultures, and, you know, and the power of music around the world is undeniable, and it's great that's available, but it's also kind of regrettable that there's not as much person-to-person communication in music, you know.
Yeah, that's a shame. You know, I've been to a million concerts in my life since I was, I don't know, 13, 12, something like that. I think my first concert actually was Jose Feliciano and Curtis Mayfield, long time ago. But
man, that's a great bill.
Yeah, how about that? But the best show, I can tell you, I saw Frank Sinatra four times. And, you know, I saw him in Vegas, Atlantic City. I had front row seats at Caesar's Palace. To see him with that orchestra, there's nothing like it. Oh, my gosh. You know, just musicians, you know.
Real, yeah.
That's the real deal.
I understand.
Yep. Some of the my favorites by the Phantom Blues Band, and people can go on YouTube to check out the band, and, of course, buy the Inside Out album until the new one comes out. Boogaman. Wow. That is such a cool tune.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to remember, like, Larry, the bass player, Larry Fulcher, brought those words to us,
uh-huh.
And they were from a poem. I'm trying to remember if the poem might have been by Langston Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from, you know, the early part of the last century. And he just said, look at these, you know, this poem. And so, you know, we wrote the song, you know, to fit those words. And that's how that came about. It's a cool tune, yeah.
It is such a cool tune. I love it. Can't Stand It, another great song. Death Letter.
Yeah, that's a Son House song.
Yeah, another favorite. Part-Time Love.
That's another classic.
Another classic. And the song you guys did with Taj Mahal, Woulda, Coulda, Shoulda?
Woulda, Coulda, Shoulda. I think that's on a Taj album.
Right, right. Great songs. I mean, this, you know...
Well, before you get done talking about all of that stuff, I want to mention Etta James,
okay.
Somebody that I worked with off and on for 20 years,
uh-huh.
That only because she was so important to me.
Right.
As a kid, I had, when I record. And I bought, of course, and I bought, you know, many records of hers after that. And, but, you know, flat, jump forward to 1988 now, and I'm playing with her. And, that's something that you can only dream of.
Yeah.
In the sense of, because she was a giant and, yep. You know, is widely respected and honored in Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that stuff. And a tremendous artist and was just quite a thrill to work with her. And she was just a fabulous artist and a lot of fun to be around, mm-hmm. too.
Well, that's going to lead to my next question. Here's a question I ask everybody. I get some interesting answers, and you might have already answered it. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, you know, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
And now, wait a minute. Okay, the Field of Dreams, what was the end of the question?
If you had the wish to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Well, I guess Ray Charles.
Ray Charles, yeah.
Yeah, well, I played with Ray. Uh-huh. Only once. It was at an event at the House of Blues in Los Angeles honoring Ahmet Erdogan, mm-hmm. who was like the guy that actually founded Atlantic Records,
yeah.
Jerry was part of that.
Right.
But Ahmet was the guy who got the money together. And,
right.
And Ahmet, of course, was a huge, revolutionary and important guy in the music industry. But Ray began his, not didn't really begin, but his solo career began with Atlantic Records. They were the ones that brought Ray Charles to America. And so Ray was at the event for Ahmet, and I was playing in the house band, and that accompanied him that night. And there were some other artists there, but I remember playing with Ray. That was like a huge moment for me. But in terms of collaborating, the collaboration with Ray Charles would consist of mm-hmm. me listening to Ray Charles. and maybe chiming in a little, but mostly just like, what he said, you know.
Yeah. Now, nobody could sing America's Beautiful like Ray Charles.
that's one of the times when a song like that really meant something to me.
Yeah, me too.
The orgy of patriotism mm-hmm. that I'm experiencing in the modern day is not doing a lot for me.
Right.
But flags across football fields and honor guards and all that stuff. I don't know what that has to do with like knocking people over, but I guess some people think it does.
Yeah. Yeah, every time I hear that, and I played every 4th of July, I always have a tear in my eye, after he sings that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, everything he sang was fantastic.
I agree with you.
He was a terrific piano player.
Yeah.
Very influential.
Yep.
I just saw a little film about the piano player Richard T.
Uh-huh.
And it was a cool interview with him, and he was at a piano, and he played with Paul Simon a whole bunch of, a lot of his records, and it was in this band called Stuff,
mm-hmm.
which was like a great rhythm section out of New York City, and that did a lot of records with a lot of people, but he was like showing this guy some different things, on the piano, and he, after a minute, he said, all of that is straight up Ray Charles.
Well, yeah.
I was like, that's right. I mean, everything that we hear comes from someplace.
Yeah.
And like, it's not, you know, imitation is the father of inspiration for yourself.
Like, oh, definitely. Yeah.
Nothing gets created in a vacuum, and what has gone before will always influence us. It's what we've heard. Everything we hear, if you're a musician, you know, everything you've ever heard is, mm-hmm. has an influence on you. And
yep.
it's like different people are the strong influences in your life, and you may begin by, you know, trying to figure out how they did that, what they played, and the way they did things. But if you do it long enough, eventually that'll morph into you.
Yeah, that's true. And like Ray, so many artists picked up what they know, I guess, from gospel and church, you know?
Well, yeah, that's why I mentioned the Harry Jacksonist.
Yeah.
You know, records that I had at my house. My parents had several albums of hers, and, you know, that was so long ago that they were like great big albums that you opened up, and they had like 6 or 7 discs mm-hmm. in them, you know, and they weighed about, you know, 20 pounds. 6 or 7 78 RPM discs, you know, with the side, a tune on each side. And, you know, like, yeah, that was unanswered talk because that gospel music did have an effect on me, and I still listen to a lot of gospel music.
Yeah. In Elvis, especially, you know, he was really
well. That affected him too.
Yeah.
You mentioned your first concert. My first concert was Elvis.
Oh, really? What year?
Oh man, I can't even begin to tell you. It was probably like 1956 or something. You know.
Uh-huh.
He appeared in my hometown, Troy, Ohio, because we had a big, a good sized arena, and. That was just 20 miles from Dayton, and the place held about 3,500, I guess, and a few more when you those were the seats, but you know, on the floor you had another 700 or 800, so there's like maybe, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people there, and I was a little kid. The thing I remember most about that show was. The mother of one of my friends had brought this girl to the show, and the mother fainted.
The mother fainted?
Watching Elvis, man. She got the joke, you know.
That's funny. Huh. I made a big mistake. I bought tickets to go see Elvis back in 76 or 77. One of his last tours, I guess, and I decided not to go, and I went to Ocean City instead, and gave the tickets. My parents went to see him, but I don't know, you know.
That's wild.
Crazy kid, you know. You know, I was heavily influenced. I was, you know, into a lot of heavy rock back then, and Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and Uriah Heep and things like that. So, I guess Elvis was not on my radar at that time.
Well, late Elvis was not the same as early Elvis.
No, not at all. No, you saw the real rock and roll Elvis.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, it was like, you know, he had like 3 guys backing him up, and Scotty Moore and I'm trying to think of the other guys' names, but, you know, small amps and not a particularly good PA system, you know, and I mean, it was still great, but it was nothing like the kind of sound you would hear today, you know. I mean, I was lucky enough to be standing, you know, fairly close, so I could hear it okay. But, you know, I don't think it was like projecting, you know, it was kind of silly to have that kind of, you know, guys with like little Fender amps and not, you know, very primitive miking and in a place that was even that big.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I guess the Beatles did the same thing with their Vox amps, you know? They were very small and they had to move Ringo around, you know, to taste different.
Well, they had bigger PA systems than
right.
like the instruments, but
yeah,
that you know that's but that was at the time, you know, having never seen anything like that, I was pretty impressed.
Oh yeah, did you take any pictures back then?
No, I didn't.
No.
I was kind of like, I mean, you know what? I mean, my wife is always nagging me. I've been to 45 different countries and, you know, on tours. And, you know, she's always saying, take some pictures.
She's right.
Know?
She's right. You know, because when
and
you want to.
I usually get a couple, but, you
yeah.
know, like I have some friends that, like, they've got, like, 65 pictures of our day in Prague.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I've got two.
I got the book, the recent book. He sent it to me, Joe Vitale.
Right.
And he his autobiography or his book has a million pictures in it. It's more pictures than words. And, I mean, he took a billion pictures all in color, and it's amazing. His book is really good.
I'm going to have to check that out. Joe and I played a lot together.
Oh, yeah. He's like you. He's played with a lot of people, you know, and we
well,
did.
We played together with Crosby, Stills, and Nash for
uh-huh.
25 years.
Oh, wow. He was on with Kenny Passarelli,
I just talked to Kenny Passarelli about 3 days ago.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah.
We did a tribute to Tommy Bolin on the radio. Trace Keen, he set it up for us, and it was pretty good. Those guys are great. Those guys are really cool.
Yeah,
yeah. Musicians are awesome, man. I really dig musicians. You know, they're down to earth, and you know, I'm not that much. And I'll say this: I'm not that much into actors at all. You know, I don't get. You know, I mean, I could meet the biggest actor in the world and I wouldn't care, you know, but a musician is a totally different story for me.
Well, I have a lot of friends that are actors, and when you get to know them, they're not too different from us.
Yeah.
They're, you know, which is to say that they're crazy.
I can identify more with musicians, though.
Oh, yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
You know, but it's the same kind of, the impulse comes from the same crazy place, which crazy in the sense of, you know, like, I'm going to devote my life to this.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like, which your chances of even making a living are slim and none.
True. That's true.
You know, but that doesn't enter the picture. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the need to, and desire to want to do this is like so strong that, you know, hey, how are you going to feed yourself? You know, that doesn't really come into the equation.
Yeah. Very, very, the odds are very much against you, you know?
Well, like, very much against you, like
yeah.
I said, even making a living, you know, and,
yeah.
But, you know, that's why, like I said, you know, lucky and good. And, you know, there's an awful lot of luck involved in anybody getting any place in entertainment, you know, whether it's music or film or
yep.
stage.
Who are some of the...
Dancing or painting or any of that.
Who are some of the actors that you know?
Well, a good friend of mine is a guy named Charles Hay.
Okay, yeah.
And people might know him if they're old enough. He was like on the show Hill Street Blues.
Uh huh. Sure.
For years, and then he went on to and appeared in lots and lots of film and films and television, and then became a director for
mm-hmm.
Many years. And you know, I know Gary Busey, who's nuts. And,
yeah.
I couldn't even begin to tell you. There's more of them, of course, but and comedians too. I know a lot of them. I know Richard Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy that's on Larry David's
yeah.
show.
Yeah.
And but a lot of people like that are kind of like, you know, guys that have been working in film for years.
Sure.
And you know, they're interesting people.
You talk about Larry David. I just had Kenny Kramer on the show, the real Kramer from Seinfeld.
All right.
Yeah, he's a very nice guy.
That's the guy that the character was modeled on.
Yeah, exactly. He lived across from Larry David for like, I don't know, 7-8 years, you know, and that's how it all started. Yeah.
Yeah.
The real Kramer.
Well, you know, thanks for modeling the character after me.
Yeah, exactly. He's trying to cash in on it. You know, he's got a tour and he does weddings and interesting guy.
That's funny.
Yeah. Mike, you got anything else you want to promote?
No.
We covered it?
I'm promoted out, man. I appreciate your interest, and it's really great talking with you.
What's your email address? Is it on your website, or do you have a website?
No, I don't even have a website. I'll tell you my email address.
Okay.
It's Mike Finnegan.
Right.
That's all one word. And of course, my last name is spelled Finnegan.
Okay.
MikeFinnegan@mac.com.
Okay, that's easy enough.
Yeah.
I'll send you the links for the show. This will be on, I don't know, maybe 30 different types of outlets.
Okay, and I'll send you some links too.
Okay, awesome. That'll be great because I want to keep up and I want to promote the new albums when they come out. I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, thanks, Ray. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. And, you know, take care of that hip. Are you in rehab or anything, or is that over?
No. I had that surgery like a year and a half ago. I'm great.
Oh, good.
That's an easy one, just a ball in a socket. You know, there's rarely any problems with that surgery. It's a real easy one. Not like a knee or shoulder or something. Those are bad. But, yeah, I mean, I was out walking around the next day and just had to do a little physical therapy to get acclimated because of, you know, I had arthritis in my hip and that was the reason I had to have the surgery because I could, you know, I was stumping around like Chester on Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
And so I had to do a lot of, you know, like physical therapy to get the muscle strengthened in that area because of the fact, you know, you walk around wrong for a year and, you know, you got to get things working right again now that you can actually swing that leg.
I had shoulder surgery and wrist surgery on the same.
Well, then you know what I'm talking about. Shoulder surgery is a bitch.
It is, yeah. And
well, the wrist is a pretty complex area, too.
Yeah. Both on my right arm, and that's my, you know, dominant arm, so I had to learn to use my left arm a lot. But, you know, I'm still afraid to, you know, like, play golf or do anything, you know? So, it takes a while. It really does. Yeah.
Much, much harder.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you're in a warm place where the arthritis won't bother you so much.
Yeah, well, oddly enough, the only arthritis that I've had so far was in my left hip.
Hmm.
It's starting to show up a little bit in my thumbs, but so far not bad.
Good. And you're still a young man, so keep up the good work.
All right, buddy.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Ray.
All right, man. Take care.
Take care of yourself.
All right. Bye-bye now. Purchase the most recent album by the Phantom Blues Band. Terrific band. Years and years of experience of musicians in the band. They are fantastic. The last album they put out was called Inside Out, and it's available at Amazon.com. They've got a new album coming out. Stay tuned, and we'll let you know about that over the next month or so. For more information about Mike Finnegan, visit www.thephantombluesband.com, and they're on Facebook, facebook.com/phantombluesband. And if you want to check out Mike Finnegan and all his music credits, you can go to www.allmusic.com/artist/Mike Finnegan. Very special thanks to the great Trace Keane for arranging this interview with Mike Finnegan, and the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news. And please check out my new book. It's finally out. The Rockstar Chronicles. Truths, Confessions, and Wisdom from the Music Legends That Set Us Free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook at bookbaby.com or amazon.com. Featuring over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends on the planet. Let me tell you who's going to be on there. Chris Squire, Dr. John, Greg Lake, Henry McCullough, Jack Bruce, Joe Lala, Johnny Winter, Keith Emerson, Paul Kattner, Ray Thomas, Ronnie Montrose, Tony Joe White, David Clayton Thomas, Mike Love, Tommy Rowe, Barry Hay from Golden Earring, Chris Thompson, Jesse Colin Young, John Kay, Julian Lennon, Mark Lindsay, Mickey Dolenz, Peter Rivera, Tommy James, Todd Rundgren, Dave Mason, Edgar Winter, Frank Marino, Greg Rowley, Ian Anderson, Jim Dandy Mangrum, John Anderson, Lou Graham, Mick Box, Randy Bachman, Robin Trower, Roger Fisher, Steve Hackett, Annie Haslam, Melanie Safka, Petula Clark, Susie Quattro, Colin Blundstone, Dave Davies, Jim McCarty, and Pete Best. Wow, that's a heck of a list, guys. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.